Ladies and gentlemen, we have a very special evening tonight and a very special speaker. And after the talk and the question period, we're going to have coffee outside so you can meet the speaker. We want to invite you all to that. And we also want you to know that the Vancouver Institute thrives on members. We don't require people to join to come and hear these Saturday night talks, but we like to have members and members' donations. And so during the coffee period, anybody who wants to join or would like to join a second time or a third time can see the young lady outside the lecture hall and help the Institute in that way. I'm going to turn the evening over now to Justice Rutan, who will introduce our speaker.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my great pleasure tonight to introduce as our guest speaker Dr. Tuzo Wilson, who is a distinguished Canadian geologist, at least that's what he started life as, and who is currently Director General of the Ontario Science Museum in Toronto. Any of you who have attended that science center will appreciate the magnitude and magnificence of the plant. Dr. Wilson, as I say, started life as a geologist, and he took part as assistant geologist in a geological survey of Canada from 1924 until 1935. Then, after serving in the Canadian Army during the war, he became professor of geophysics at Toronto, University of Toronto, where he remained until 1974, and then took his present post. Dr. Wilson has been the recipient of many medals and awards and has published over 100 scientific papers, as well as having written several books, including textbook on physics and geology. But what intrigues me about Dr. Wilson, if I may say so, is what is written about his leisure interests, as it's called. His leisure interests include making visits to over 200 universities in 100 countries, from the North Pole to Antarctica, it's said. His hobby also is walking. I don't know whether he walked from the North Pole to Antarctica. And he possesses a Hong Kong junk, which he uses to sail with on the Great Lakes. I think you'll all agree with me, ladies and gentlemen, that we have a very eminent speaker who was eminently qualified to talk to us about earthquakes in China and elsewhere. Are they becoming more frequent? Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Justice Rutan and ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to be back in Vancouver again and to have the opportunity to speak to the Vancouver Institute. I feel I have a long-standing connection with British Columbia, rather indirect one, it's true, but my grandfather settled on this coast in 1853 as a doctor with the Hudson Bay Company. And my mother was born in Victoria, and there's a mountain on the Alberta-British Columbia border at Moraine Lake, which she was the first person to climb, and which many years afterwards was named after her. So I feel that I have some connections with this province that date back a long time, though I myself, due to the fact that my mother met my father at Banff, and they had finished building the Exshaw plant, cement plant, which some of you will know in the Alberta side of the mountains, and the next plant that my father, as a young Scottish engineer, was suggested he should build was in Ottawa, so I was born in Ottawa. Well, it's very nice to be back and to have this opportunity to talk to you and to speak about Chinese earthquakes. Well, I've been in China a couple of times on short visits, but I would not claim to be an authority on Chinese earthquakes. But they have had a severe one, and as early as 58, when I first went to China, they were expecting it. And so it is perhaps worthwhile saying something about the earthquakes in China, but particularly about earthquakes in general. And the only excuse, really, that I have for speaking here is that much more is known about earthquakes now
than was known up until about just about 10 years ago. The general notion of the Earth that geologists and geophysicists have had, and everybody's had since early days, was the Earth is a very solid, rigid body. And there are many common expressions denoting this about terra firma and so on. And therefore, it was with surprise, I suppose, that the early explorers of the Atlantic Ocean noticed that the two sides were similar in shape. And for several hundred years after the Americas were discovered, there was a general notion abroad that the two sides might have been rent apart, but certainly this had happened in the early history of the Earth, and they had been sort of driven apart at some early stage in the Earth, which was not well known, not known at all, in fact. The first person to suggest that there had been a slow movement of the continents was not Alfred Wegener, as is often supposed, but actually Taylor, an American glacial geologist. But Wegener proposed a similar idea very shortly afterwards, probably quite independently. He was a German meteorologist. And the idea of continental drift was given its name by Wegener. And this was that the ships, that the continents were like ships that moved through the surface of the Earth independently of one another. Well, nobody could understand how this would occur. They couldn't understand how ships of solid rock could move through ocean floors of solid rock, or what would propel them. And so the idea was not very popular. It was only accepted by a few people. And this situation remained until less than 20 years ago. At that time, new evidence was forthcoming, particularly about earthquakes and about the ocean floor, some also from magnetism. And this suggested that the motions really had occurred. But the information which had not previously been known about the ocean floors, they're very hard to explore, being hidden from sight and requiring expensive expeditions to investigate, suggested that the situation was rather different from what had been previously thought of, and that the continents were not moving like ships, but rather that the whole surface of the Earth was broken into plates, as though one had taken a hard-boiled egg, and broken the surface and moved the shells, pieces of shell, a little bit relative to one another. One can also, continuing the analogy, suggest with an orange. If this is the Earth, when one starts to peel it, one can see that the fragments of peel are like plates. And if you break the whole of the orange into, if you peel the whole of the orange and get a number of these plates, well then, this is the situation in the surface of the Earth. The crust of the Earth, as it were, is broken into plates, like the piece of peel. And movements in the interior cause them to jiggle a little bit. And so that the motions of these plates is what causes earthquakes. Now, if the plates move very slowly and steadily, not very much harm results. The trouble is that the plates catch on one another. There's friction between them, and hence they move in a jerky fashion. And it's these jerks that cause earthquakes. And this new idea that the Earth's, whole of the Earth's surface is broken into plates is called plate tectonics. And the continents are parts of these plates, but the boundaries only sometimes coincide with the continents and the continental margins. Sometimes they're out in the middle of the ocean floors. Well, I think I can explain that further if I go to the slides now, and if I can learn how to manipulate these wonders in this magnificent new building of yours, I will... Hopefully, lights are on and... Oh. We pick up the red phone. In case of emergency, pick up the red phone, call the operator. Ah, success. Thank you. Yes, lights out. Now we're all... Now, I have here a picture from the National Geographic with which I've been conducting a minor feud, but they gave me this. It is a map they never published showing the continents as they possibly existed a matter of about 200 million years ago. And you can see here Africa, Arabia, South America, North America, Eurasia, down here Australia and Antarctica. And there is only one great continent and one great ocean. And this split up by the breaking up along the Indian and the particularly the Atlantic Oceans. Now, Wegener suggested that this had happened, as I say, a matter of about 190 million years ago. We've got things mixed up here. Thank you. And they had been together. Well, there was some uncertainty about the exact pattern, but you see a similarity between this pattern and the one we've just shown. And they gradually broke up, and the oceans expanded, and they adopted their present shape, present positions. Now, the evidence that Wegener relied on was partly the shape of the continents and partly geological fit. This is a cliff in Tasmania. And from the top of that cliff, you look out to the Antarctic, way to the south. This is overlooking Hobart. This is the cliff you just saw in the foreground. Here's the town of Hobart. And 2,000 miles away is Antarctica. I made this trip from New Zealand here, going from springtime in New Zealand, equivalent to crossing the Atlantic, not so wide as the Pacific, but about as wide as, nearly as wide as the Atlantic, and arrived at the coast of Antarctica. And here is these black cliffs here, they weather differently, of course, with no vegetation, but they're exactly the same in age and composition as those we showed you in the first slide from Tasmania. And these are in Antarctica. And there's exact match in many features of the geology. Well, not only are there these matches between the Antarctica and the southern continents, but also on either side of the Atlantic. There are many, many of them, and they do very strongly suggest that the oceans had opened. Now, how could this happen? How could these masses of solid rock move apart? Well, part of the suggestion lies in this picture of the coast of Antarctica. It's a wild coast. Out here is the frozen ocean, and this is a spit of sand, a beach, which has come up out of the sea. It's raised, a raised beach. And approaching it closer, we see that it is, we're going to land on it. It has buildings on it in connection with the International Geophysical Year. These pictures I took in 1958, and they were investigating various things in the Antarctic. And perhaps some of you in the foreground can see that the picture is speckled because there are 250,000 penguins also nesting on the beach. And here's a close-up of the penguins and some of the buildings in the background. Penguins are rather strange for birds. They have very small wings, as you can see, which they use for swimming rather than flying. And as there are no land animals and hence no enemies for them on land, they're rather fearless and behave rather more like fox terriers than the average bird. They have strong beaks and claws, and but one can attempt to pick them up. But one will get scratched in the process, but they're not very afraid of one. Now, this beach, here's another view of the monument to Scott down there. Scott, incidentally, of course, was found by a man who died recently, Sir Charles Wright, in British Columbia, a Canadian. He found Scott's body. He was a member of the Scott expedition. Now, that beach has raised up out of the sea, and it's become apparent that the surface of the Earth, this shows various views. First of all, they thought the Earth was solid, except for the core, and mountains were formed by contraction. And then they thought the Earth had circulating currents in it. But now it's thought there's a thin layer, just below the black layer there, that is white hot, and slightly plastic. So the surface of the Earth, the black layer, like the skin of the orange that I showed you, is capable of being broken. And it rests on a layer down here which has a couple of arrows in it. And that part is white hot, not under very great pressure, and is capable of being deformed like white hot steel is capable of being deformed before it melts, or like ice can flow down a mountainside in a glacier. So that if a load is put on the surface of the Earth, it will squeeze some of the white layer out and go down, and then when the load is taken away, the land will come up. And this is what happened to that beach in Antarctica. At the height of the Ice Age, there was more ice in Antarctica than there is now. And so part of the load has been removed so that the land, the material is flowing back, and the surface underneath Antarctica is coming up, and the beach has been raised above the surface. Now, this idea was known vaguely more than a century ago, but as I say, recent investigations have shown much more about the ocean floors. In particular, it's exposed the fact there's a great mountain ridge runs down the middle of the Atlantic through Iceland, through the Azores, past St. Helena and Ascension Island and Tristan da Cunha, and then into the Southern Ocean, and it joins up with the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea and the African Rift Valleys, and then continues between Tasmania and New Zealand and Antarctica, where I showed you the pictures earlier, and across the Pacific to the Gulf of Mexico. There's the Gulf of California, and through the St. Andreas Fault and off the British Columbia coast. So this is much the largest mountain system on Earth, and there's a great crack on the surface of the Earth. It's to be compared with another system which runs through the Andes, the mountains and the Cordillera, and through these island arcs and out to New Zealand and then across the Himalayan Alpine system. And it's now realized that along this crack through the oceans, the seafloor material is coming up and spreading apart, and the continents are moving away, but that where the younger mountains and island arcs are, the ocean floor is pushing against the continent, or India is pushing against China, and forming ridges as the plates come together. So the Earth is divided in by these great fracture zones into plates, and the plates do not always correspond with the continents. On the west coast of the Americas, there's a plate boundary, but on the east side, there's no plate boundary down through from Nova Scotia to Florida or around Brazil. The plate boundary is out in the middle of the Atlantic, somewhere else. These boundaries are very conspicuous. This is a view of the Andes with the Pacific Ocean out here, and you see there's a tremendous disturbance, and these mountains are 20,000 feet high. Here is another view of a boundary between plates. In this case, the plates are not shoving together. One is sliding past another. And this bend indicates that this plate is moving northward, moving up relative to this one. This is a view looking downward from a plane of the St. Andreas Fault in California. And the earthquakes are caused by the occasional motions along this. If the motions went on every year, and every year there was an inch or two movement, and it amounts to 2.5 inches or something a year, then that'll be all right. The difficulty is that the motion is sometimes stopped by friction, and no motion takes place for a while, and suddenly one side jerks forward relative to the other as much as 20 feet, and this causes a serious earthquake. I can't show you a picture of the rifts in the middle of the ocean, except in Iceland, a few places like that, they're under the sea, but here are the plates as they're now recognized. There is the Americas plate, which includes both Americas and half the Atlantic, the African plate that includes much more than Africa, the sea around it, and the Eurasian plate, and the Pacific plate, which is most of the Pacific Ocean, and the Indian-Australian plate, which includes both those continents and much of the ocean, and the Antarctic plate, which also includes a lot of ocean. So there are only six big plates, and there are also several smaller ones in here and around here. And one of particular interest to British Columbia, the little Farallon plate that lies off the coast of British Columbia and Washington. And it's the relative motion of these plates that causes a disturbance. Some coasts, like this coast of Patagonia, are not a plate boundary. And you see the great contrast between this plate boundary and the Andes way over here. This is Argentina, this is the Atlantic Ocean. There's no boundary along here, no disturbance, just a gentle shoreline. The boundary is way out in the middle of the ocean, through some of those volcanic islands that I mentioned. So what is happening then is that the plates are, currents are coming up and separating the plates, and they're moving either way from the middle of the oceans and overlapping under mountain systems and under island arcs and overlapping and going down. And where they push against each other, where there's friction, the earthquakes occur. It's this shows the distribution of earthquakes in Canada, produced by the federal government. And you see, the best place to live if you don't like earthquakes is anywhere in the interior. But you're fortunate in British Columbia compared with the people in California. These stars and spots represent earthquakes. The bigger ones are stars. They're mostly offshore, off beyond the Queen Charlotte Islands, beyond Vancouver Island. Down in California, the St. Andreas Fault goes right through California. The situation is very much worse. There are some residual minor fractures coming up the St. Lawrence, and some earthquakes occur along there, and some in Baffin Bay. But generally speaking, Canada is fortunate relative to some other countries, it has comparatively few earthquakes. There is this boundary offshore here, but it's not a very active one. It does not go through the land anywhere in Canada. It enters into Alaska at Anchorage. The Alaskan earthquakes are not shown here, nor the American earthquakes, but there was a very bad one, you remember, in 64, where this line of earthquakes reaches Alaska, and also there are from time to time bad ones where this line of earthquakes offshore reaches California. But right past British Columbia, it's separate from the land. The other locus of earthquakes that might concern Canada lies through Iceland and the Azores, and is a long way off. And these are relatively minor. So this separation of continents, and they're coming together, gives rise to the idea of a sort of concertina action. You get a crack, and the continents are broken up and move apart, and the ocean gets wider and wider, and then on the other side of the Earth, some other ocean must be getting smaller, so that oceans go in and out like concertinas over the course of time. And if we take as a mature ocean, an example, the Atlantic Ocean, the two sides we've mentioned were observed shortly after the Americas had been discovered to fit together. Now, another ocean that the sides fit together is the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, and that seems to be an earlier stage, a younger stage. And the East African Rift Valleys are, in the opinion of many people, perhaps the beginnings of an ocean that's not yet come apart. There may be one through Nevada that's going to break apart presently, too. Well, then, on the other side of the world, as the Atlantic gets bigger, the Pacific is getting smaller, and maybe the Mediterranean is largely closed up. Finally, the Himalayas have closed up completely. So that mountains may be where the two sides of a former ocean have banged together. And this has a big effect on the details of geology because ocean basins are so large. I won't go into the effects on the sediments and igneous rocks, but they're very well known to geologists. Here is one of the rift valleys in Africa. This is perhaps the beginning of an ocean. There are lots of big faults or fractures through the foreground here, and there are some other lines of fractures in the middle, and in the distance is the other side of the valley. It is a definite depression across here, a valley about 30 miles wide, and there are a number of small volcanoes and lava flows in the middle of the valley. In the Red Sea, and this is another view of the Rift Valley, which I took 2 or 3 years ago, driving down to Lake McGarty outside Nairobi. This is the edge of the Rift Valley along here. There are faults through there. You see the blue hills in the distance on the other side, and there's a lot of lava in the bottom. I had an interesting time on the way back. I had two flat tires and spent the night in a grass hut, which some natives very kindly looked after me. And I thought the dogs made an awful lot of noise outside. It wasn't until next morning I discovered they were hyenas, which would have made me sleep even worse than I did because... Although it's very cold, although it's very tropical and on the equator, it's high enough to be quite cold in Kenya. And in the Rift Valleys, of course, there are many of the game reserves lie in these rift valleys. And even driving along the road, you see these animals and others. And in the natural game parks, one of which lies only 7 miles from the center of Nairobi, you can see lots of these animals, quite wild, but still relatively tame. Now, this is a satellite view, one of the few pictures I didn't take myself here, of the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea. And this is Arabia here, and this is the Horn of Africa. Now, the fit doesn't appear to be very good, except if you look along these two sides, these fit, sides fit fairly well. But unfortunately for our story here, there's been a lot of extrusion of lava and so on. It's rather obscured, the picture. As we'll see in a moment, further north in the Red Sea, the fit is excellent. But at this corner, there's been a lot of volcanic activity. Ethiopia is a mountainous region, which of course is why it has remained an independent country so long. And the Yemen is also a rugged country, which is why it's independent of Arabia, no doubt. You can see the hills and the clouds on them here. These mountains rise up to 13,000 feet, no mean height, and many of them are volcanoes, and a lot of the disturbance has spread out into the Red Sea. But here we see the beginning of the East African Rift Valleys. This valley here, this gulf, the Gulf of Tajura, leads on to the Rift Valleys, so we have a three-way junction between the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea, and the East African Rift Valleys. And it would appear that this uplift is due to something poking up from below. We don't know the exact appearance of it, but somebody evoked to suggest that this is the way it looks. There seems to be an uplift in Ethiopia and a cracking apart, and as though some hot plume of material from the hot interior had come up and lifted the surface, and the volcanic activity had ensued and poured out, causing this uplift at the triple point. Now, this action of the triple point, I think we can best explain by using the lights. If I can find out there. Now, I want to explain about this uplift. And I think I can do this best with a piece of cardboard. And so, if you're going to have an uplift in the surface of the land, it's not enough to have one fracture like this. Obviously, it's difficult to have an uplift on the cardboard like that. It's better to have several breaks like this. And then you can bend the sides up, you see, and you can have an uplift. And if you, so that you must imagine that at in Ethiopia, that you have an uplift like this, that the Yemen has been uplifted here, Ethiopia and Somaliland here, and the cracking, and it's necessary to have three cracks, has allowed some lava to come out. Now, if you're going to separate Arabia from Africa, and this has happened, then it's only necessary to have two of these cracks extended, this one and this one. You see, then we can separate the two sides. And this side doesn't matter then. This third arm was necessary. The third arm was necessary in order to get the uplift, because one crack wasn't enough. We have to have three of them meeting at a point. And this produces the uplift, as you can see. I've lifted these sides up. And that causes allows certain volcanic activity. But then in order to separate Arabia from Africa and form the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden, it's only necessary for two of those cracks to open up. And you're left with one blind side, and you saw the Gulf of Tajura hadn't opened up very much. And this fits in. It's all very simple, it seems so, but it took a little while to realize this. Now, I... wait a minute. I go back one. There, that's it. See, one crack is not enough. You have to have three in order to get the circular uplift. And then in order to separate the oceans, you only have to open up and you will have one valley that's blind. Now, since this is going to develop into an ocean, This is normally a valley and has a current and a river coming down it, as the arrow indicates. Then this river will flow into a bay in the sea, in the side of the sea. And later another mountain range may come in and close. And when that happens, the direction of the river is reversed. And this has all been found to apply in actual reality. Now, here's another example of this. This is the view we were looking at of Arabia upside down, the Red Sea, Gulf of Aden, and that third arm that is unnecessary, this being Africa upside down, Arabia upside down, the Red Sea, Gulf of Aden, and the third branch. The same thing applies if we bring South America here up against Africa here. Then we have the South Atlantic opening and the Central Atlantic opening, and we have a third failed arm which exists. It's the valley of the Niger River and its tributary, the Benue. And this is an important valley system in Africa, and it's interesting that there's a lot of oil accumulates there. And this is a characteristic feature of these, that oil accumulates at these places. Now, at the other end of the Red Sea, we have this situation. I told you the fit was very much better up here. This is looking down the Red Sea from the north, and you see the two parallel sides, and these bays and capes correspond to each other very well. Over here, the Nile Valley, not actually the Nile River, but the Nile Valley that's irrigated shows up over here. Here is Sinai, and the Gulf of Suez, and the Gulf of Aqaba. And the reason the Red Sea's been able to open is the sliding has occurred along this side here. And it extends up through the Gulf of Aqaba and through the Jordan Valley, right through Israel and into Syria and Turkey. Now, this is the view along near Eilat. This is the Israeli side, and this is the Jordan side here. This is the road to Eilat, and this is the Jordan Valley on which this slip occurs. And I think now we change slides, and I will continue this paper cutting operation and show you a little more. We now go to the north end of, you see, now recognize this is the Red Sea, this is the Gulf of Aden, and here is the Blind Valley. Well, up here we now have to open the Gulf of Aqaba and the Gulf of Suez. And we, of course, get the same uplifting again here. And the uplift produces the Sinai Peninsula. And the reason it's uplifted, of course, is the reason it's of strategic importance. I believe it's 9,000 feet high, though I haven't checked that. Now, in order to separate Africa and Arabia completely, we need to cut that across there. And then we need to slide along here. We can slide along here, you see? And then we can, by sliding along here, we can separate the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. And if we, indeed I forgot to do this, but if we put a jog in it, you can see how the Dead Sea develops this way. Because if we separate along this, if we're sliding them and there's a jog, see, you could open the Dead Sea. You may laugh, but this is really what happened, I believe. So that's the, I forgot to put that in. Well, of course, the interesting thing is that people who wrote the Old Testament knew about this. And they were quite aware of the fact that earthquakes occurred along the Jordan Valley. And I shall now read from Zechariah chapter 14, verses 4 and 5. This is not the version of the Bible to which I'm accustomed, but it has the advantage of being a more accurate translation, I believe. I think it's a more modern translation. And therefore, it perhaps describes more clearly than the St. James version would have exactly what it went on, though they're rather similar. And his feet shall stand in that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof, towards the east and towards the west. And there shall be a very great valley, and half of the mountain shall remove towards the north, and half of it towards the south. So that is precisely, you see, what we said was happening, that the Mount of Olives was cleaved and the sliding motion moved half it towards the north and half it towards the south. Now, of course, I was there at Professor Ben Mannerheim has held forth on this and published considerably on this, and somebody embarrassed him by saying, but Mount of Olives is not in the middle of the Jordan Valley. And he admitted that it was about 50 kilometers out, but he said that as poetic license. However, these earthquakes have occurred not infrequently in the Jordan Valley, and another example is given in Amos chapter 8, verses 8 and 9. Shall not the Lord tremble for this, and everyone mourn that dwelleth therein, and it shall rise up wholly as a flood, and it shall be cast out and drowned as by the flood of Egypt. Shall not the land tremble, you see? And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord God, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in a clear day. Well, according to the authorities, that suggests that that particular earthquake occurred in 760 B.C., because the second verse says, it shall come to pass, and it shall come to pass in that day, said the Lord God, that I will cause the sun to go down at noon, and I will darken the earth in a clear day, which is a reference to a total eclipse. And so that the total eclipse that would have been possible in the time of Amos to affect the Jordan Valley, total eclipses are not all that common in any one place in the earth, can be dated and has been dated at 760 B.C. Now, there are often eruptions in connection with this, and in Genesis 20, chapters, verses 24 to 26, and the movement on these faults, as I've said, often gives rise to volcanic activity. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven, and he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. Then, of course, his wife looked back and was turned to a pillar of salt. But the volcanic eruption, the brimstone fire from heaven, was due to the eruption occurring on one of these, at the time of one of these earthquakes, and the volcanic activity that accompanied it. And apparently this also bears on the question of the location of Sodom and Gomorrah, and there's some archaeological evidence that suggests that they were located in a suitable place for close to a volcanic eruption. So that it's interesting that people living in a rift valley, you may say it's surprising that these things are mentioned in the Bible, but I don't think it's surprising at all. Anybody who's experienced an earthquake would be very much aware of the very bad effects and very much aware of the displacement of the land. And it's not surprising that they would record that. Now, I think we're ready to go on with these slides. Well, then, I've suggested that a series of these uplifts, one at the top of the Gulf of the Red Sea and one at the bottom of the Red Sea, they might give rise to this sort of separation. And this story has been developed quite a bit in geology. Now, we'll go back then to the Red Sea and then the spreading of oceans. The oceans spread by uplift along the central axis and spreading either way, a new material coming up in these cracks and spread, forming new ocean floor and separating. Now, it so happens the magnetic field of the Earth varies and therefore imprints patterns, which you see in these dark lines, on the seafloor. And these patterns behave then like growth rings. All the black lines were formed at the same time, on either side here, on either side here. And these gray lines were formed at another time, but also they were all formed at the same time, the gray lines. So they're like tree rings, and therefore you can, in the case of the Atlantic Ocean, plot now the tree rings, as it were, showing the central axis, which runs up through here, through the Azores, and up through here, and the rate at which they grew. And these lines represent growth lines of the Atlantic, and they can be mapped now by magnetics on the ocean floor and have been mapped. And the separation of Africa began 190 million years ago and is still proceeding. The rate of separation is an inch or so a year, so that we are separating from Europe at about your height in your lifetime. And if you fly across to Europe and back and think it takes longer coming back, you're quite right, it does. Well, the Pacific is a more complicated picture because, as we've said, the Andes and the Cordillera and the island arcs on the other side represent places where the continents are coming in on the Pacific Ocean. And indeed, they've overridden this ridge. So this ridge, which used to be a median ridge, now runs into the continent and goes underneath the continent and forms this great shear, which is so dangerous in California. And elsewhere, we see volcanic eruptions. This is the top of a volcano in New Zealand. Apparently, the pilot thought it was safe to go around, and we got a bit of a bump when we went over the smoke, but it's more like a chimney than anything, really. And it's fortunate for them, New Zealand, though they do have the danger of volcanic eruptions, they also have the advantages of volcanic steam. And they drill holes with an oil rig here and get steam blowing out of the ground and are able to put this to good use and operate considerable hydroelectric stations with them. I don't know if this could be possible in British Columbia. It can be done in California, Japan, in Kamchatka, Iceland, New Zealand, and Italy, in many volcanic regions. It may be that some geothermal steam will be found in British Columbia. I would not be surprised. The people, they may say, well, the Earth is hot. Why don't we do this everywhere? The difficulty is in most parts of the world, say in Ontario, if you drill a deep hole in the ground, sure, the ground gets hotter down there, but no steam comes out. And if you pour cold water down, well, there may be a puff of steam, perhaps temporarily, but it would soon get chilled, and no more steam would come out. So that it's only in a few places where you could drill a hole and get such jets of steam that will come out for years on end. And then continuing our idea of the oceans as concertinas, we get to the Mediterranean, which is closing up. And we have activity along the Atlas Mountains and through Sicily, Mount Etna, Vesuvius, and there's former activity in the Dinaric coast, and there's activity in the Greek islands and through Turkey. Mount Ararat is a volcano, and the island of Santorini or Thera, according to whether you use the Italian or Greek name, in this region is an active volcano. And this is Vesuvius, walking along the top ridge and looking down on the crater on one side, the Bay of Naples on the other, and Pompeii and Herculaneum, which were covered by the ash in the eruption. This is looking down into the crater at a time, of course, when there's no eruption and it's just a big pit with a certain amount of gravel in the bottom, volcanic rocks. And at the base, Pompeii here was buried by the eruption of Mount Somma. The darker part here is Mount Somma that erupted in 79 AD. The Vesuvius has grown up like a teacup in the saucer since 79 AD. And as you saw in the earlier picture, the material that was blown up was ash. And so the Pompeii was buried in ash, not in lava. And that's why it's been possible to dig it out. The ash can be taken out with a pick and shovel and a wheelbarrow, whereas lava could not, of course. And very little of Herculaneum, I think, has been dug out because at Herculaneum there was much more lava. Of course, a few of the pillars have been put up, restored to their former height. But for the most part, you can see the level at which the ash buried the city. Well, we went out to Santorini one time in March or April, when you could get boats quite cheaply, and went out to Santorini. I took my wife and daughters out there, and I'm sorry I put that. No, that's all right. This is a slide of where we went. This is the coast of Africa and the coast of Turkey, and here is Greece, and Santorini is right there. And this is the island of Crete. Well, Santorini is a volcano that erupted about 1300 BC. And the signs of that eruption are very evident at Santorini and also on the seafloor in all this region. The eruption was a very major one, like that in Krakatoa in Java in the 1880s. And the ash is still could be dredged on the ocean floor in all that region. And it thickens towards Santorini, and there's no doubt that it was Santorini where the eruption took place. And at Santorini, it's about 100 meters thick. But in one place, they have dug down, found evidence, the old city of Thera, which was buried. Now, the description of Thera and Crete match very well with the description given in Plato of the lost city of Atlantis. According to Plato, there was a round
island and a rectangular island, but the rectangular island was bigger, and that would be Crete and this would be Santorini. And the only description of Atlantis on which everything is based is given by Plato. And he said they were overwhelmed and destroyed, and it was the destruction of that time of the Minoan civilization. The Minoan civilization was situated in these parts, and the eruption of Santorini would have been a tremendous catastrophe. It had completely destroyed and buried the city of Thera in ash, and the waves that would result would destroy harbors and shipping around about, and the ash would bury the fields for a year or two and have a very adverse effect on the agriculture for that time till they were dug out again and new crops planted in all the surrounding region. The only thing that makes it difficult, of course, is some people say, but what about the Pillars of Hercules? Well, the Pillars of Hercules were not identified by Plato as being the Straits of Gibraltar. And there are a number of other promontories now. These places could have been the Pillars of Hercules in the old vernacular. The Greeks in those days, 1300 BC, were undoubtedly sailing around these islands and making the jump over to the Africa, but there was no reason for them to go all the way down to the other end of the Mediterranean. Their ships weren't very good, and they had no reason to go down there, and there's no evidence they did. So I believe that this is the story of the lost Atlantis. And here is the shape of Santorini today. It is the shape of, this is the volcano. It had a conical shape, but the top was blown off and collapsed, and a little lava came up again in the middle. So this is the pipe of the volcano, and this is the ring of the volcano, and this is where the city of Thera was buried. And today, from inside the harbor, you can see this view of the inside of the crater with the modern city of Thera built on top of it. And this is, the sea has penetrated into the pipe of the volcano. Now, while we are on that subject, I can give you one more reading from the Bible which refers to this matter. And it is in Exodus 10, in chapters 21 to, read verses 21 to 23. And the Lord said unto Moses, stretch out thine hand towards heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even darkness which may be felt. And Moses stretched forth his hand towards heaven, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. Well, this is a very good description of what went on at Krakatoa, where there was a very big eruption there in the 1880s. The cloud of ash, which was sufficient to bury the places nearby 100 meters thick, 100 yards thick with ash, was enormous. And this was all blown up in the air and spread over a large part of the Mediterranean. And so it obviously darkened the sky. And if you can imagine that much dust in the sky, that much ash in the sky to darken it, obviously you would be able to feel it. It would grit your teeth. And the darkness which could be felt, I think, is an excellent description. And it also went on for about that period of time before the wind blew it away. And so that the people in Egypt would certainly have seen this cloud, and the sky might well have been darkened where they were. And of course, Moses also, though he may not have seen the eruption, was aware of this. And in Exodus 13, verses 21 to 22, and the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of the cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people. Well, this, of course, was the eruption. And a volcanic eruption would be well described as a pillar of a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. So, and Moses was living in 1300 BC, and that was the only major eruption at that time. So it seems a fairly good case. Well, now finally, we get to the closing of the ocean. We've been through the rift valleys where they began to open, the Red Sea where they got wider, the Atlantic where they got wider still, the Pacific they were coming together, the Mediterranean they were closing, and now the Himalayan mountains as viewed from the Indian side. A great wall of mountains uplifted by the collision of India with the rest of Asia. The Indians, of course, have mapped faults and disturbances on this side and shown nothing on the Chinese side. And we'll see the same thing in reverse on the Chinese side.
Also in Burma, of course, which is a fascinating place we were fortunately able to visit, this is the Great Golden Pagoda. There are volcanoes, and here's a couple of views of Burma. The temple, the Golden Pagoda, is a golden temple, is very active place of religion today, Buddhist religion, and a very fascinating place to visit in Rangoon. And here is one of the priests in the country nearby, and his little attendants carrying his luggage for him. And as I say, the Burmese are very religious people, and you see lots of signs of this in the villages and in Rangoon itself. And here is one of the volcanoes. No, we haven't got the volcano. But anyway, there are volcanoes in Burma. But also, we go on to India, and we can see the Himalayas. I realized that I would be in India on this trip in October or November, and therefore I got up in the early morning and got a taxi and drove a long way into the mountains. And at dawn from the foothills here, we could see the main range of the Himalayas with the morning light coming onto it, and the clouds still filling the valleys. It's a very splendid sight. And later on that day, I think we got another view here from the foothills looking at the main range of the Himalayas. It was my good fortune to hit a cloudless day, such as occur almost exclusively in the autumn in October and November, where they're quite common. The rest of the time, the mountains are generally hidden by cloud. This is the only place in the world where the mountains we're standing on, which are 12,000 feet high, are referred to as foothills. And you see the heather flowers, and such as you get in British Columbia. And it's well watered and fertile, and forests here, a very pleasant part of the world, if you don't mind the altitude. And they are indeed foothills, these ranges along here that are well forested, because behind them there's a Trissol here, I think this is Trissol, and back here Nanda Devi, which are 23 and 25,000 feet high. And further along they're even higher, of course. So they're twice the height of the foothills. And you have, in effect, one mountain range piled on top of another. And it's a very spectacular scene indeed. And then I was able to see the other side, the Chinese side and the Russian side, by going across on the Trans-Siberian Railway a number of years ago. And I passed Lake Baikal and some of the places that were disturbed by this collision. And now we have to get on to a second stage, and I'll come back to the part about Russia and China in a moment. But you see, we've gone through this cycle, this concertina thing, and they've closed again. And now we find the mountains reopen. This cycle didn't happen just once. It's gone on several times. And we have evidence of this in the Atlantic. In the Atlantic, we have mountains the same age in Norway and in Scotland and Ireland and in the east coast of Greenland, the Caledonian Mountains, the same age as the Appalachians and others in Morocco. They all form part of a single mountain range. And a matter of 200 million years ago, they were all together. These continents were together. And the coming together of these continents had formed these mountains. Well, then they separated again and broke up, and we have the mountain range separated into parts in Eurasia and parts in North America and parts in Africa. And we can see evidence of this. We have a feature here that's very conspicuous, this great fault through Nova Scotia, the Aspie Bay Fault. And I'll go back and show you where it occurs. And we can match many of the features together. We have the Aspie Bay Fault goes through Cape Breton Island. There's a great fault through Newfoundland. It just touches the north coast of Ireland and goes through the Great Glen in Scotland. And this fault is of the same age and the same type of motion as we get also in the Scotland. And this is the Great Glen across Scotland and has a fault just like the one in Nova Scotia and lined up with it. And the fracture has been worn away and has locks at either end and in the middle. And the Caledonian Canal has joined these together so the ships can go through Scotland by the Great Glen. And it still has occasional small earthquakes along it. The Loch Ness is the big lock in the middle here, which we see. And I didn't realize at the time the significance of this, but this picture is perhaps the only one you'll see with a genuine Loch Ness monster in it. But what it is, I don't know, but there it is, so that I'm convinced the Loch Ness monster exists. Though I suspect that it's some driftwood or peat that's risen from the bottom. Well, then when we bang India into the rest of Asia, we not only close the mountains in Burma and close the Himalayas and the Hindu Kush, but we also start the breakup of the continent again. And there's a line across here, which, except they stopped mapping, would continue right across here to the mouth of the Lena, and another line that goes through here, it continues over to the Amur River. And so that the breakup of the continents began again. India, barging into southern Asia, has uplifted Tibet, which is about twice the height of the rest of the continent, and has raised up the Himalayas and started this series of fractures that cross through here. And from the Trans-Siberian Railway, I was able to see Lake Baikal, which is right here, and see the fractures there. And in China, I've seen some of the fractures and uplifts in these parts. And again, there's volcanism here, which was recorded in Chinese history books. It's surprising to think of volcanoes in China, and even more surprising to find that Tibet is largely a volcanic region. There's no part of the world that has been less known than the plateau of Tibet, from a geological region anyway, because most of the people in Tibet live in the Brahmaputra Valley, which is about 12,000 feet high, and very few people either live in or visit this great plateau, which is very, very barren, cold, high, and a desert. It's about 16,000 feet high and a very miserable part of the world. Well, about the only geological and scientific party that have crossed it is that of Sven Hedin early this century, and they went across here and left a record, which is published in German by Noreen. I was in Stockholm and inquired whether any of Noreen's rocks were still available, and they said, oh yes, they're in the basement of the Institute. And Kevin Burke, who was at that time working with me and is now at Albany, went and over to Stockholm and got parts of these rocks, brought them back. And they all turned out to be volcanic, as Noreen had said, and he was able to make some further studies on them. And this map, though, was made from satellite pictures. And it shows these tremendous fractures, these black lines of fractures in the coast in Asia, running from the Himalayas north into China. And these are all active faults. And this is the reason why there are so many earthquakes in China, because the impact of India has fractured this part of Asia, particularly along a series of lines through here and a series of lines through here. And these are actively moving, and there are many of these faults, and they're all actively moving, so you get lots of earthquakes in China. That, coupled with the fact that the people in China are very numerous, and most of them live in poorly constructed houses of mud or loess or caves, which fall down easily when the land is shaken, is the reason for so many catastrophes. And one of the worst earthquake disaster on record occurred at Xi'an in 1556, which is in here, when they recorded the death and the names of 820,000 people who were killed in a single earthquake, besides unknown names. And perhaps the second worst earthquake disaster in history occurred last July. I wouldn't be certain of the figure, but the number of 600,000 has been suggested at Tang Shan, which is, this line should really be extended, except Molnar stopped mapping the photographs, and this line extends over here. Now, Peking is in here. So this series of breaks through here were known to the Chinese. They were not known so well as in here, but they were aware of their existence, and they were very fearful both times I visited China that earthquakes would occur. They were quite right. They thought they were due for one. And Tangshan is a city of about 1.5 million people. And in July, in a single earthquake last summer, about 600,000 people were possibly killed. And the Chinese have been rather reticent about the figures, but this seems to be the generally accepted figure. About 700,000 were injured, and only 200,000 people escaped alive. You can imagine the scene of disaster in a city of 1.5 million with 1.3 million casualties in a single night or in a single instant. A number of Canadians have been to Tangshan. It's not really very inaccessible. It's near Peking. I've seen pictures of the city before the disaster, but there's also been a University of Toronto hockey player who was through there. I haven't met him, but I've seen a number of people who have met him. And the train stopped there, and he said there was not a single building left standing intact in the whole city, as far as you could see. There just is a mass of rubble with pieces of buildings sticking up here and there. So these are very terrible disasters, and there have been a very large number of them, due to the continued motion of India northward, uplifting Tibet and fracturing this region. Now, these lines were mapped from air photographs.
And in addition to getting the information about the volcanoes here from the rock specimens, Sven Hedin's trip, other photographic information shows there are a lot of cones and craters here. And Kevin has been mapping these and has located a number of these volcanoes through this region of Tibet, probably due to the fact that the doubling up of the crust and the friction and so on resulting has produced a lot more heat and produced this volcanism, which might otherwise be surprising in the middle of a continent. Now, as I say, I was through here on the train, and but down here I also visited this region, which has been uplifted. Not so much as Tibet, but still appreciably uplifted, and uplifted by this relatively recent, geologically recent motion. And this is the Chinese view of it. You see, it's not as complete. The geological mapping of a large region like China is not as well as advanced as it would be in more developed countries. And the Chinese have plotted the earthquakes in spots where they've occurred. They've plotted some of the main faults. They knew where they were. But the picture is not as neat as the one before. And of course, the one before was done by Molnar at MIT from Earth satellite picture imagery. And this was done from ground observations. But the two confirm one another very well. The Chinese have typically left out all reference to Russia and India because, well, that's natural. They don't have the same information about those countries. So, but you can see how very many earthquakes there are. They're generally concentrated on these lines of fracture, and they're widespread all over the country except this region down here. The vicinity of Canton and Shanghai, all that plain in there, you don't need to worry. But as soon as you get into the Tibetan region, or particularly bad down here in southern China, and across Mongolia, and Sinkiang, and up around Peking, and down the Amur Valley, there are very many. And it was in this along this belt through here that the Chinese were expecting another earthquake, because they hadn't had a bad one for some time, and they unfortunately got one last summer. This is one of the faults, and this is how they're mapped from imagery. You see, it's not very difficult to see that there's been displacement as along the St. Andreas Fault. And these are folds in the mountains taken from American satellite imagery. We were able to see this because we went into Yunnan in the north of China and came out by motor caravan. We'd gone in by air and expected to fly out, but you can see the weather is very bad. The picture is very dark and there's clouds. And we came out with these Chinese cars several hundred miles by road across a part of China that people don't normally drive across. The road, however, was for the most part paved. The cars were Chinese, and lots of new planting along here. And we passed the deeply dissected valley of the valleys in the Ordos Plateau. The Chinese said this is the what we call the Colorado of China. They admitted it's not as big as the Colorado River, but has the same effect. There's been an uplift to the land, and the rivers at the bottom of the valleys have kept cutting, and the land has been uplifted. The land was originally flat and has been raised up as a plateau. And so this, the rocks are horizontal, and this is the result of these motions. And there is a certain amount of volcanic activity and earthquake activity connected with it. I had good opportunities in China to talk about these things. The first time I went, I met Li Shangpeng, who is the leading seismologist in China, and had been given the task of making maps of the seismicity of China when the new regime came in the 40s or early 50s. He's studied at Caltech and is well known to North American geologists, and he is at the Seismological Observatory outside Peking. And of course, having studied in the United States, he speaks English fluently and is regarded as the leading authority on Chinese earthquakes. And he was very concerned with the onset, probable onset of this Peking earthquake. The second time I went, I was received very graciously by Dr. Guo Moreau, who's the president of the Academy of Sciences of China, a friend of Mao Zedong, an archaeologist and historian and literary figure, but nevertheless the president of the Academy of Sciences. And we had an hour and a half chat with him in this situation, and my wife had a chat with Madame Guo Moreau, who's a very ardent communist, and this is Mr. Li, the interpreter who accompanies, amusing and entertaining and very capable interpreter. So we were well received and also were taken home by Dr. Gu. Dr. Gu is a Colorado School of Mines graduate and is running the Institute of Geophysics in Peking at the present time. And this is his wife and another seismologist and my wife and myself outside the Gu's apartment. When we told the people at the Canadian Embassy that we were going to have lunch with the Gu's, or had lunch with the Gu's in their apartment, they were astonished, because it's undoubtedly very uncommon for Westerners to be taken home by Chinese as their house guests. But we had a very pleasant lunch there, and were very kindly treated by Dr. Gu, and as I say, he speaks English fluently, and is an experienced and able seismologist and geophysicist. Well, here's a closer picture of him. Very nice man indeed, and I'm glad to say that we've been able to return his hospitality, that he came to North America with a party of Chinese seismologists, and came to our home. And so it's nice to be able to confirm the fact that there are interchanges possible between East and West, and there's no subject in which they're more easily negotiated than the study of earthquakes, because you cannot export or import earthquakes, you can't trigger earthquakes, and everybody is affected, many countries are affected by them, and there are therefore great advantages in exchanging them, exchanging information about them. There are, as a matter of fact, about 10 times as many earthquakes in China as in California, and about 10 times as many in California as there are in the Jordan Valley. And so that there are advantages in learning from the people who have more experience in earthquakes. And this is one of the first subjects in which there was an exchange between the National Academy of Sciences in the United States and the Peking Academy, because it was realized it was a nice, safe topic to discuss, benefit to everybody. And indeed, this point of view was already recognized, I suppose, many 50 years ago or more, 75 years ago, by the Jesuits, who have long been prominent seismologists, and the reason is that it's a good, safe, unpolitical subject. And the Great Wall is interesting in this connection. Needless to say, if you go to China, they show you the Great Wall, but the seismologists point out that it also had its uses in that respect. Being 2,000 miles long, 2,000 years old, and crossing a number of these faults, one could measure the amount of offset in the Great Wall, and therefore it provided a record of some of these disasters of the past. Another thing that interested me very much was the structure of the architecture. You see this heavy roof of tile is supported on pillars, and one might suppose that it would be very sensitive to falling down in an earthquake. But the structure in here, which is typical of Chinese architecture, is a rocker structure, with the rockers that move on top of one another, right angled. And so that what happens when an earthquake comes, the pillars move back and forth, but the roof is able to, with this rocker motion, to stay steady and not fall down. And this is a type of architecture that has been developed over the years to prevent heavy roofs falling down in moderate earthquakes. And probably a very severe one will bring it down anyway. And this picture I took in 58, and you'll notice that the thing is rather lacking in paint and so on, and therefore it's at the Summer Palace. It was interesting to see the same structure again in 72. By this time, if you look, there's much more detail, and the painting had all been regilded. The whole thing had been redone. This, of course, is a monument to the emperors. It was built by the emperors, by the Dowager Empress, I suppose. And it's interesting that the present regime has restored this sign of imperial splendor. And it is indeed evidence of nationalism is very strong in China. We were really shown what went on in China to a considerable extent. This is an institute and a university with 6,000 students, and we were taken into the laboratories and shown the equipment, and it was quite genuine. As you can see here, the young man and the young woman, she has a geological hammer, and she's pointing the way to the young man, which is a very different thing from what Confucius would have recommended. But it also indicates it's a geological and geophysical institute. And indeed, the whole university of 6,000 people is devoted to the study of the Earth. We were taken into factories and in the instrument rooms. This is where they're building insulators, and it happens. These were probably, many of them, designed for the Tanzanian Railway, which is built by the Chinese and is 500 miles long, and some of them, no doubt, for Chinese railways. But we were really shown what went on. People are sometimes doubtful about this. The factory was full of slogans up here, which of course we couldn't read, but undoubtedly political in nature, and this was also characteristic in all these insulators drying. The Chinese, of course, have been very much interested in earthquakes as a result of building these factories and building the railways, because when they build big railways across the Yangtze River and others, they don't want them to fall down. So they've been very interested in discovering more about the history of their earthquakes. They have history of earthquakes back to 1159 BC, but they say the earlier 400 years is probably not very reliable, which is probably reasonable and honest, I think, too. And since then, they have had a record of most of the earthquakes that have occurred. Li Shangpeng, whose picture I showed you, was responsible for organizing this. The Chinese hadn't known very much about it before. And in the early 50s, when he was told to find out where the earthquakes occurred in China and predict where they would occur in future, he realized that by putting some instruments in, he could locate where the earthquakes occurred in the more active regions, because generally where small earthquakes occur is also where big earthquakes occur. So even locating a few small ones in a few years would give him some idea where the big ones might likely occur along these big faults. But the part of the country to the south of Peking, which is less active, puzzled him. But then he thought that he would do it a different way. He would not use instruments. So he said that if he had 250 historians and studied students of language, and if they would read the entire literature of China and give him references to all the earthquakes mentioned in the vast Chinese literature, that he thought he could sort out where the earthquakes had occurred. So he was provided with the 250 literary figures, and they read the literature of China and produced 10,000 references to earthquakes. But of course, people didn't move around very much in those days, and since they knew where the people had lived and when they'd lived, they were able to sort out the 10,000 references into a much more limited number of earthquakes and indicate from the number of references how wide an area and how big an earthquake this had been. So he was able to produce the Chinese map of earthquakes from this literary study. The Chinese railways are remarkably good, as a matter of fact. We were due again to fly from Xi'an to Nanking, but the weather was so bad and we were behind schedule. They said we just couldn't wait for the planes anymore, we'd have to take the train. And they apologized that the train we would take was coming from Urumqi on the Chinese border and was to Shanghai, a run of 88 hours, and that we'd have to catch the train at 4:17 in the morning, and we'd have to get off again at Nanking at 1:25 the next morning. And I don't know if it was our surprise or not, but at any rate, it was satisfactory to record that the train did arrive at 4:17 in the morning as scheduled, and we were quite comfortable on it. And it clearly had been across the Gobi Desert because it was all covered with yellow dust, and it got in on time into Nanking. I'm showing you these pictures so that we really did see what went on. They're making instruments, and we went through the factories where they saw these instruments, and we saw them, besides geophysical instruments, we saw them making optical instruments, and including microscopes. And they said they had made this telescope, which they tracked the two Chinese satellites. One doesn't hear very much about the Chinese satellites, but at the time in 71, they had two little ones they had launched, which they tracked with this telescope, which all seemed quite reasonable. And we also, because I remonstrated when they wanted me to take me to communes and poultry farms and trade fairs, I said I want to see more geophysics. They quite unexpectedly in Shanghai took me out to Zakowai, which is the old observatory founded by the French Jesuits in 1874. It was founded as a magnetic observatory and an astronomical observatory, but later became a seismological one also, and is about 50 miles outside of Shanghai. So we drove out there, and here is the bottom of the telescope, which had been installed by the French Jesuits, and this astronomer here, this lady, still spoke French and remembered Father Leger and other Jesuits who'd been there, whom I'd met subsequently in Paris, quite well. So that it's interesting to record that science really has its roots back in the old days, that in any country, nobody is more likely to survive disruptions and revolutions than scientists, because particularly the communists say that they want to develop their countries on technological grounds, And they know that they can't suddenly take a lot of youngsters and give them experience, so they have to use the scientists they have, so that the scientists who were trained by the Jesuits and the scientists who were trained abroad are still the scientists of China. And it was a pleasure to meet many of them. And they're doing quite sensible things and carrying on using some of the old equipment and making a great deal more new equipment. They're a very hard-working lot. They have to be. They have big responsibilities, but it was very pleasant to meet them. I must say these trips also had the advantage that they took us in out-of-the-way places. I don't imagine from the astonishment at which we were greeted at Zarqawai that they'd had any visitors before. Certainly they had them very rarely, and we therefore drove through the country through places where tourists don't normally go. And I must say it is possible to record that the state of agriculture, the state of education, and the general improvement of the country is going on, the paving of the roads, the planting of young trees, which you can see here. And so we did, I feel, my wife and I, and myself on the first trip, my wife and I on both trips, on the second trip rather, were able to see quite a lot of what really went on in China, and it was encouraging to see it. And I hope that I've said something about the earthquakes in China that will give you an idea of why earthquakes occur, where they occur, and illustrate the fact that until 10 years ago, we didn't really appreciate the fact these plates were moving. And now we know how the plates are moving, and we know where some of the boundaries are, and we can relate this back in the Middle East back a couple of 2,000 or 3,000 years, in China 2,000 or 3,000 years, and see that the story is now a coherent one, and that we understand very much better what is going on. It would be nice to record that we can now say when earthquakes will occur. We can say where they will occur. We can give some indication of the probability of their size and danger and their frequency, but we cannot yet say precisely when they're going to occur. Well, there's a good deal of talk a couple of years ago, indeed a year ago, that people had started to predict earthquakes. And indeed, they had been fortunate in predicting a few small ones. But there's been much less talk of this since the Peking earthquake because it was not predicted. And neither the Americans with instruments or the Chinese with a few instruments and a lot of farmers watching natural phenomena have been successful in really predicting earthquakes. So it remains a problem for the future. But now that we understand the motion of the plates, we think that possibly progress may be made. In addition to predicting earthquakes, of course, it would be very much more important to do something to ameliorate them. It's often been a puzzle to seismologists what they would do if they knew that a bad earthquake was going to occur at a certain time, or if they thought it was likely to happen, because it would be quite a problem to know whether to disrupt the whole life of the city and move everybody out of the country, and then maybe the earthquake wouldn't occur after all. It would be a difficult problem to predict. It's like predicting hurricanes, only a worse problem. But there is some possibility of ameliorating earthquakes. The earthquakes, as I've indicated to you, are due to the motion of plates. And if the plates would move steadily all the time, then there would be no problem. There wouldn't be any earthquakes. It's when they catch and jump ahead in a jerk that the earthquake ensues. So there has been a suggestion that by pumping water along a line like this, one might lubricate it and allow the motion to go on steadily. I don't think there's any prospect of stopping the motion because it's a worldwide phenomenon and much too large a scale. But there is the possibility of lubricating the fault so the motion be steady. Nobody has really seriously ventured to suggest that they would go to California and pump a lot of water into the St. Andreas Fault. In the first place, it would cost tens of millions of dollars. In the second place, if any earthquake ensued, the people who did this would certainly be sued. They'd probably be sued even if there wasn't an earthquake. And the consequences are just too large for anybody to have undertaken the problem of trying to ameliorate and alter the motion of the St. Andreas Fault. It may be, if a disaster occurs there, that something will be done in the future, but certainly not for the present. Thank you.
Dr. Wilson is aware of our policy of inviting questions, and he said he'd be quite happy to answer any questions put to him. Yes?
Where the main points of friction are, and if they do, could they say re-explode them with a small explosion?
Well, they know where the fractures are. I've showed you pictures of them. It's very clear, and it's California where the St. Andreas Fault lies. It could be easily seen on the ground, and it's true from satellite pictures that you can see them also. So they know where they are. I don't know that letting off explosions would do any good. The idea is to lubricate them so they move steadily. But the trouble is that in any region that is liable to have severe earthquakes, nobody's ventured to interfere with nature yet, because they might be accused of having generated the earthquake, even if they'd not done so.
That's the question of whether they're becoming more frequent or not. I believe that last year we had two earthquakes above 8 on the Richter scale, and all throughout the year there was reports of earthquakes. Which, do you feel that they're becoming more frequent?
No, there's no evidence that they're changing very much. They're like automobile accidents or other things that are statistical in nature. Some years there are a few more than other years. But last year was not very much more. What was unfortunate last year, of half a dozen bad earthquakes, all but one occurred in populous places, and therefore they made the news. Certainly, if several hundred thousand people were killed in Peking, and I think 1,300 in Italy, and a similar number in Guatemala City, and others in the Philippines and in Turkey, these were events that made the news. But usually, more of the earthquakes occur in the bottom of the sea or in deserts or in places where there are a few people and little damage is done, and then they don't make the news. As it happens, the second largest earthquake last year, nobody ever heard about. It was in the sea off Fiji, and nobody paid any attention. And yet it was a much bigger earthquake than the one in Italy or in Guatemala City. But it didn't kill anybody, so it was not recorded. Well, I think the continents have been moving back and forth regularly. The first slide I showed you, the picture of Pangaea, which was a single continent, was Wegener's concept, but it's now apparent that it was brought together. The pieces had come together not very long before. It hadn't been together more than a few tens of millions of years. The continents are moving, the plates are moving constantly around and moving pieces of continent together and moving them apart. Well, I don't like to make predictions in the future, but because they won't come together for tens of millions of years, and we won't be around to know. But I would think if they carry on the way they're doing, they probably would come together.
Can you explain the concave shape of island arcs, concave away from the subduction plate?
Yes, it was explained by Franks in about 64. If you take a tennis ball and press it, the dimple will be circular. And it means that you're trying to push the shell of a sphere into a sphere, and the way that you push the shell of a sphere into a sphere is along a circular arc, and that is the reason the arcs are circular. It's because you're pushing the Pacific floor down underneath the coast of Asia, and so it tends to develop a circular arc because that's the shape which it prefers to adopt, as you can see by just squeezing a tennis ball.
Our fault is west of our coast, of our mainland. Why are we in the heavy damage area and the Canadian chart?
I'm asked, why are we in the heavy damage area here in Vancouver of the Canadian charts when the earthquakes occur, for the most part, the fracture is offshore, 100 or 200 miles out in the Pacific? Well, the chart is only a Canadian chart. You're not in the heavy damage area compared with Japan or California, but it's only the heaviest danger area in Canada, but not so severe as it would be in other parts of the world. It's a comforting thought.
Yes.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear.
There are earthquakes frequencies in the ocean. Why doesn't the water be
When earthquakes occur under the ocean, which you were asking about, what happens to the water? Well, sometimes it gives rise to big slips of mud, and these give rise to what are called commonly tidal waves or tsunamis, which sweep across the oceans and do cause great damage. There's one in 46 in the Aleutians that did considerable damage in Hawaii. The one in 64 in Anchorage, Alaska, killed a few people on Vancouver Island. So earthquakes occurring on the floor of the ocean do disturb the water from time to time.
That wasn't the question. He says, why doesn't the water lubricate the earthquake?
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear the question adequately. Well, because it doesn't penetrate. It's just resting on the surface. Just pouring buckets of water around the surface wouldn't lubricate the St. Andrews Fault. You'd have to drill holes and pump water in under high pressure.
Did the oil company support research in plate tectonics in the mid-60s?
No, they didn't like the idea at all. They were about the last people to accept it. Oil companies are hierarchical institutions, and they're very reluctant to accept any new ideas. They can't. I know this very well because I had to go down and lecture to the research labs in oil company about plate tectonics because the younger men believed in it, but the older men had to be convinced as they had to bring somebody in from outside. They wouldn't believe their own experts. I'm sure this is the reason why they were so wrong about predicting oil reserves. It was not a rip-off, as is commonly said to be. It's just the oil companies are conservative. And once having thought, the older men thought if you just worked hard, you found more oil. Why didn't the young fellows go out and find more oil? They didn't realize the situation had changed. No, it's interesting. This has been a scientific revolution, like the one that Copernicus had when he suggested, contrary to popular belief, that the sun was the center of the solar system, not the earth. A very astonishing idea at the time. Or ideas and revolutionary ideas at the beginning of the century in physics. The idea that the continents were moving was a revolutionary idea, a scientific revolution. And hence it was not accepted by the establishment. The last people to accept it were the geological surveys, the mining companies, and the oil companies who had the most to gain. It was mostly people like German meteorologists who knew nothing about the subject, Wegener was a German meteorologist, who made the suggestions about plate tectonics. Nobody has predicted one yet because I've said we can't predict them, but there hasn't been a major one since 1906. There has been some thought that the Palmdale Bulge, which is not in San Francisco but near Los Angeles, is a predecessor, a forerunner of an earthquake, but this is uncertain. Simply, one knows that earthquakes do occur from time to time all along the San Andreas Fault, which runs from the Mexican border to north of San Francisco, and that they occur irregularly along it, popping about one place or another along it. And nobody knows where the next one will occur or when it will occur. All they're sure is that they will continue to occur along that fault.
Is there any evidence that there's a change in magnetism at all prior to the development of a very serious earthquake in the rocks near to it?
Yes, the study of magnetic phenomena close to an earthquake has been used as a basis of prediction, but as I say, it was unsuccessful in the case of the Peking earthquake and a number of others, so that these are not sure guides.
You mentioned something about Antarctica having the weight of the ice on it,
yeah.
Being pushed down at one period of time, and then as the ice melted, it came back up. Well, I was wondering whether this same sort of effect might take part in other places of the
Well, you're quite right that it was first noticed in Scandinavia, where there had been an ice sheet until 20,000 years ago. When the ice melted, the land started to come up and has been coming up ever since around the Baltic Sea. The same thing is going on around Hudson's Bay in the Canadian Arctic. The land is still coming up. And it was from this that they got the idea that the Antarctic is coming up. of course, people say, well, there's still ice on Antarctica. But there was more ice 20,000 years ago, and some of the ice is gone, so the load has been reduced and the land is coming up. Well, it's a large amount of energy is required to move the plates in human terms, but not so large in terms of a body as large as the Earth. The inside of the Earth is certainly very hot. It contains radioactive elements that are generating more heat. This heat is probably trying to get out and is probably trying to give rise to some sort of currents, same way as in a pot of water on the stove. The heat from the bottom tends to give rise to currents that move. And some sort of explanation like that, probably a type of convection, the exact details are not known, is probably causing the surface of the Earth to move very slowly.
Yes.
Could we someday get electricity by harnessing potential earthquake or volcanoes?
The question is, can we get energy from earthquakes or volcanoes? I don't know how one would harness an earthquake. It has a great deal of energy, all right, but how this would be done, I don't know. The volcanoes, there are a number of places around volcanoes, in Italy near Vesuvius, in New Zealand, in Kamchatka, Japan, Iceland, and so on, where volcanic steam is being used. And it's possible that some may be found in some place that's suitable in British Columbia, as in California.
Well, I think we've exhausted the energy of our speaker tonight so far. I think I'll stop the questions there. I'll ask Dr. Wolkoff if he'll give our thanks to the speaker.
I'm a regular attender of the Vancouver Institute, and it's always a question, what is it that draws a crowd as big as this one? And I think that our speaker today gave